Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast today, Restore the Rapids is underway, and we get an update. Cannon Township hosts a reading of the Declaration of Independence, as well as a Thomas Jefferson lookalike contest. We talk to author Tom Kelvin about the book Vengeance, highlighting the sesquicentennial of Custer's last stand. We talk about the book Fighting for New York, Activism for Health and Social Justice since the 1960s. We also talk about cancer rehabilitation and cancer prehab. And we talk to Ford's heritage and brand manager about how Ford is celebrating America 250.
Grand River Restoration has entered the river. July 1, a big day for Matt Chapman and his team as Grand Rapids Whitewater Executive Director. Be careful what you wish for. Here it comes. Matt, good morning.
Good morning, Shelley. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you. And this headline does move us forward with obviously a project that's been in the waiting for a bit. Catch us up to what's happening, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. Last week was a really exciting time. After almost 18 years of design and engineering and a whole lot of permitting, we finally were able to drive the construction equipment into the river to remove the first of the four dams and start to restore the rapids. So it was really exciting last week to see that equipment go in the river, and just a ton of thanks to all of our partners at the City of Grand Rapids and our local philanthropic partners and everybody in the community that supported this idea of restoring the city's namesake rapids.
And let's stay with that big picture, Matt. I know you've been involved, and now as the executive director, falling on your shoulders, what's the big dream here?
You know, the biggest thing is to try to activate the river, get more people into the river to use it, to really just make the river the heart of our city. Grand Rapids was named that way for a reason, and as you know, so many people come to the city and say, well, where are the rapids? So the first phase of construction that we started last week that will last for roughly this summer and then all of next summer will remove the four smaller dams between Bridge Street, just upstream of Bridge Street, down to Fulton Street, and we'll construct a series of boulder features that are designed to mimic natural rapid feature, natural riverine features that are found in other parts of the state. So this is just the first phase of the vision. The second phase would be the potential removal of the 6th Street Dam and the construction of a new lamprey barrier to stop the spread of invasive sea lamprey upstream. And that would actually restore kind of the historic bedrock rapids that Grand Rapids was likely named after in the early 1800s. So a really big vision, a lot of work, a lot of time. This is just the first start of the construction, but there's more design and engineering and permitting to go.
Does that worry you when we say permitting from experience in the past?
Well, one of the things that we're trying to do is learn from the past, right? And obviously this is anytime you do an environmental project like this in a river or a lake or stream, it's very complex. The fact that this was done in the heart of an urban city where we have flood walls and infrastructure, bridge piers, things like that, makes it very challenging. But we've learned a ton over the last really 15, 16 years. So we are taking what we've learned from this kind of lower reach that we're constructing now and working on that with several partners. So this is not the upper reach will not be just City of Grand Rapids and Grand Rapids Whitewater, but we're actually working with the Great Lakes Fisheries Commission, which is a bi-national agency that incorporates members of Canadian Fish and Oceans, and then as well as other state and federal agencies. So we're taking what we've learned in the lower reach and trying to apply that to the upper reach, and just really continuing the momentum that we have. And again, getting in the river this last week was just a huge milestone after years of work. So we hope to see that kind of continue, and we just keep on moving out there.
Yes, that's what we do, keep on moving. Matt Chapman with us again, Executive Director of Grand Rapids Whitewater. Tell me more. This, you somewhat mentioned this, it was quoted by your river restoration project manager. Is this about strengthening the connection between our community and our river that runs through it?
Absolutely. So, you know, when this idea first started, it was really this idea of, you know, how do we take the dams out of the river and create more recreational opportunities? And Grand Rapids Whitewater really kind of led with that recreation vision. Excuse me. But the more we studied the river, the more we learned about the invasive species, the federally endangered mussel species. We have several species of state-threatened fish like the lake sturgeon that have cultural significance. The project really evolved to be kind of this holistic river restoration. So the idea of restoring the river, the ecology, but that leads to more of the investments in the river corridor. 10 years ago, when I started with Grand Rapids Whitewater, there was this idea that the restoration of the river would be a catalyst for the redevelopment of the river corridor, but we really didn't know what that meant. And, you know, now, of course, we can sit here today and we see the amphitheater and the Grand Rapids Public Museum and the soccer stadium and several other projects that are really starting to incorporate the river, and the river is truly becoming a community asset. So as we look to the future, I think this is going to be just the beginning. You know, we hope to see a lot more programming events along the river, more people in the river. And then really we're eager to see how the river responds and, you know, what the ecology does. And we hope to see an even better fishery, more habitat for fish and mussels, things like that. So it's a really substantial project.
Waiting to see when we, yes, can get in that river. What do you need from the community, Matt?
Right now, you know, we just encourage people to come out and take a look at it. There's great viewing from the construction from all of the local bridges. We are just asking that Annapolis Park is closed to the public, will be closed for the duration of construction. So respect the construction boundaries. The river is still open. But again, if anybody is going to be fishing or wading or canoeing or kayaking in the river, we just ask that you give the construction crews plenty of room to work safely. There will be a lot of equipment and rocks and boulders and trucks and things like that coming in. But please come out and enjoy it. You can check the City of Grand Rapids website. They will have a link to a project page that will be offering kind of weekly and monthly project updates. And we're happy to share what's going on with the community.
Sharing is good. Matt Chapman, thank you very much for you. And we'll, as they say, keep in touch. Take care.
Yeah, thanks, Shelley.
Again, Matt Chapman, good man, Executive Director, Grand Rapids Whitewater. Let's continue the topic of the Declaration of Independence. Even though our July 4th has come and gone, it's not going anywhere, this declaration and this celebration of the 250th anniversary. Cannon Township is all over the map. How about you residents and visitors invited to take part in a unique community celebration this Wednesday? We'll let you talk all about it. One trustee herself for Cannon Township. Also on the side, there's a little swift printing going on. Jessica Sladen, Gutowski Sladen. Good morning to you, Jessica. Always a pleasure.
Good morning, Shelley.
What do you have on?
Oh my gosh. This actually is a George Washington costume I wore this past weekend at the boat parade on Bostwick Lake.
Okay, and how'd that parade turn out?
Well, we are victors, I will tell you that. We had the White House, we had George, we had Trump, we had Abe Lincoln, we had Secret Service agents, Lady Liberty. It was a hoot.
I was in town. I would have been there with the roving mic. That is for sure. Jessica, many hats you wear. Yes, congratulations with your work and family-owned Swift Printing. But let's put the trustee of Cannon Township on and talk to me about what's happening Wednesday.
Sure. A few weeks ago, actually less than 3 weeks ago, one of our residents, Shirley Davies, came to me and said, "Hey, Jess, there's a statewide thing going on, national thing go for the 250th anniversary. Folks are reading the Declaration of Independence, 6 p.m. on July 8th. And she asked if I would be interested in doing something or putting something together for it. And, you know me, my initial thought was like, absolutely, how can I make this happen? But I wanted to go back to the board and make sure they were all in because, you know, I could do this event individually, but it really should come from a government angle, right? So we all are honoring the history of this sacred document. And so I asked about it in the board meeting, and my colleague said, yeah, do it. Run with it, Jess. And so here I am in George Washington. Also, I think this could go as Thomas Jefferson, right?
I think, you know, you're right. When you walked in, I thought you were Thomas Jefferson. So because that's basically what this is as well, an inaugural,
yes,
Thomas Jefferson look-alike contest.
Yes. So you can wear whatever colonial attire you want, but we're trying to engage our youth, right? So this document is a very sacred document. Our, you know, country's been around for 250 years. But it's like, how do we keep sharing that history and not being disrespectful or making light heart of it, but also how can we make it fun and engaging? Because I love history. but I didn't always love history in school. So let's make it more engaging. Let's make it more theatrical. Let's get folks excited. And so the idea was we're going to read the Declaration of Independence, and we have about 20 different folks reading it. It's going to be, I keep joking, it's going to be like a kindergarten performance where all everyone's lined up and they each read their two sentences.
Efficiency,
but,
yes.
Yes, we're going to keep it moving. We're going to read. And then if you want to dress up like Thomas Jefferson or any colonial attire, you can wear it. And then we'll have a contest afterwards, seeing who wore the best costume, you know, as a youth. So any kids who want to participate, and the adults can wear like the best colonial attire. Like I think this passes as Thomas Jefferson.
I think so too, for sure. I mean, you're basically asking wear the white shirt, creative colonial attire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't know if we have that in our backyard, but or a best interpretation of one of the Americas.
Right.
Now, founding fathers, let's go there. May women enter this contest?
Oh, of course.
Thank you.
I like to just think of that as the antiquated knowledge, right? Founding fathers, founding mothers.
That's where we're going.
Absolutely. Everyone's invited. Everyone's included.
Good.
Where
are we headed?
We are headed to the Cannon Township Historical Museum. It's right on Cannonsburg Road next to the Honey Creek Inn, if you're familiar with that nice little spot there. And so we're going to start there. Doors will open at 5:30. The declaration reading will start at 6 on the dot. I'm thinking that will take about 20 minutes. Then we'll jump right into the best costume. And then it's kind of a progressive evening. So after that, you can walk to the fire department, which is directly adjacent. So they'll have an open house there. And then Honey Creek is the spot after that. So think of it, you come have a good time, learn some public safety things with the fire department, and then enjoy fellowship and community at the Honey Creek. And the best part is the contest, Honey Creek is matching gift cards. So where it's going to be $100 prize per contest category. So I think it's a pretty good incentive to be there. And just a reminder, there's been no taxpayer dollars used to put on this event. This is all just folks coming together for a good time.
Thanks for that mention, for sure. Let me get more into the specifics. In general, who are your judges?
Sure. So the judges are going to be the township board. Steve Grimm, I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's our supervisor in Cannon Township. He would have loved to be here right now, but he had a judge that he had to meet with, so couldn't join us. But he's quite hilarious. Mm-hmm. And so I think he'll do a very good job, not only being respectful for the history, but poking fun at the costumes. Like, you should have heard him making fun of my silly costume.
I think
this
he was jealous.
Let's go with that.
Did you hear that, Steve? I think that that would get you a head turn, as they say. Jessica Gutowski-Sladen with us, Cannon Township trustee, owner of Swift Printing, along with getting involved in the community in many ways, specifically with this opportunity to watch and hear the Declaration of Independence, which is, let me finish that, and Thomas Jefferson Lookalike Contest this Wednesday, which is, I mean, how many of us have actually sat and listened, I'm talking to myself, listen to a reading of the Declaration of Independence.
Right. It's just not something that, unless you're a really big history buff, that you pay attention to that too much. You can easily YouTube it to listen to it, but why not get an amazing theatrical experience and hear from lots of different folks in the community speak the Declaration? And it's a really cool document when you think about it. 250 years ago, the people that wrote this, where they might have been in their headspace and how fed up they were with that government. It's
history.
Pretty cool.
Yep. So prizes for most presidential Jefferson, best youth Jefferson, people's choice Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
So bring your people.
Yeah, well, cheer is loudest, right? You know, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and most creative colonial attire. Mm-hmm. So start that. You've got plenty of time. Does one have to register?
You know, if they would ahead of time, I'd love a head count. But you know me, Shelley. I just want to get people there. So if you're sitting on your couch and you happen to just listen to this episode right now, Shelley Irwin, we just want to have you at the township, and the more the merrier. Don't think, do I belong? You 100% belong. This event is open to everyone, and we're staying political neutral. So we've got Republicans, we've got Democrats, we've got independents speaking. This is not a campaign party. This is community coming together, putting our country first.
Good. All allowed, as they say. Been doing any printing lately?
Oh, you know me. I love printing. It's a political season, so I can't complain one bit.
That's right. Okay, well, good things happening at Cannon Township. Appreciate your trusteeship and more, yes?
Yes, yeah. The fun fact, so we have the Rockford address, but really the population in Cannon Township more than doubles the city of Rockford proper residents. So I think there's around 6,000 residents of Rockford, and there's like 14,000 Cannon Township. So that's always interesting. We all have the Rockford address, but Cannon is technically a bigger location.
Good. Thanks for that information. Details one more time for Wednesday, please.
Sure. We'll see you July 8th at 6 p.m. at the Cannon Township Historical Museum. We'll have a live reading of the Declaration of Independence with lots of fun, energetic folks from all walks of life presenting. Then we will have the Thomas Jefferson Lookalike Contest. And then you got to stop by the fire department and then have to go to the Honey Creek Inn to enjoy your winnings and relish in the fun with your neighbors.
How fun is that? Is there a best website or a place to find?
Sure, canontownship.gov. We have a press release on there. Also on Facebook, Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson Lookalike Contest. It's on there. And, you know, I wanted to say one more thing, Shelley. There is, if we can really honor our history, I really think it helps us be better stewards of our community in the present day.
Yes. Thank you. Jessica, go get them. Be careful. One may call you Thomas as you leave. So,
love it. Call me TJ.
Thank you.
Thank you.
He's a best-selling author, as rightly he should be. He brings us back to history with many of his prior works, and no stranger to this latest. Let's talk about this 150th anniversary of Custer's Last Stand. So, hence, Vengeance is written by you, Tom Clavin. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back on your show.
We've talked before. We'll talk again. What are you known for in general? Do you take us back to history?
I like writing about history. I'm very lucky because I've always been a history buff, but I'm lucky because I get a chance to make it an occupation and write books about topics that fascinate me. And the Battle of Little Bighorn is one of the most iconic battles, really, in American history, so here's my chance to write about it.
And for some of us that have totally forgotten some of these battles, you bring it back to life because it happened. Let's get into Vengeance, the last stands of Custer, Crazy Horse, and Sitting Bull. You revisit, what, this Battle of Little Bighorn on the 150th anniversary?
That's what I'm doing. I'm revisiting the battle, but also revisiting the situation with the last stands of Custer, Crazy Horse, and Sitting Bull, and that Custer's Last Stand is well known, but what's not as well known is that for Crazy Horse, the Sitting Bull, and the Sioux and Cheyenne, it was kind of their last stand too, because the part of the Vengeance title is that because of the defeat of the U.S. Army at Little Bighorn, the American government really came after the Indians, and it was their last stand, and they didn't really have any fallback position. So it's kind of it's really an American tragedy in a lot of ways. Most people think of it as a tragedy for Custer, but it's a tragedy for the American Indians.
All right. Take us back to history. Was the Battle of the Little Bighorn a devastating defeat for U.S. forces?
Well, it was because Custer, we have to remind ourselves that what a big figure Custer was. He was a major celebrity in a lot of ways in the 1870s. Excuse me. In the 1870s. And he was the most famous Indian fighter in the country. And to have him go out there expecting a great victory and instead not only lose a battle but be killed with 200 of his men was shocking to the rest of America.
So let me ask you also to define your characters. The Last Stands of Custer. And remind me, Crazy Horse?
Crazy Horse was a Sioux warrior and mystic, and he was the most famous among the Sioux and Cheyenne. He was the most famous of warrior leaders. Sitting Bull was the top guy. I mean, he was not a fighter himself because he was in his 40s. That was considered too old to be a warrior, but he was the person who directed everything. He was a medicine man. He was a chief, and he was the one that came up with the strategy that let Custer come to him and trap him and then surround him, and that's basically what happened.
And how about Sitting Bull?
He was a, what they call a hunk papa, which is a subdivision of the Sioux, and he had grown up as a fierce warrior, and he was sort of like a warrior emeritus when it came to Little Bighorn, because he wasn't going to go out there and fight himself, but he directed everybody, and everybody knew to go to look to Sitting Bull for how to fight that battle. So he developed a strategy that was a new one. He had everybody fight together, which is strange for the Indian tribes, who are usually rivals with each other. But he got them all to fight on the same page, basically, with a common enemy.
It's Tom Clavin with us. Vengeance, the last stands of Custer, Crazy Horse, and Sitting Bull. More of, yes, the inside story, also the story of Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse. Let's see. It also, this battle also marked the end of the effective native residents of the Plains Indians. Expand here.
Well, you know, until Little Bighorn, the Indians had pretty much their way with the open plains. They could hunt, they could fight each other if they wanted to for prestige and steal each other's horses. But increasingly, as more and more settlers came west, and the army had to build forts to protect the settlers, the Native Americans found themselves with less and less territory. And Little Bighorn was basically the biggest defeat for the American army in the plains, but it was also the turning point for the American Indians, because in the aftermath of that, they were hunted down, they were forced on reservations, they were killed, and they were starved. They surrendered in large groups because they couldn't endure winters anymore without the buffalo. So it was a turning point, Little Bighorn. It was a victory, yes, but it was what they used to call a Pyrrhic victory. It cost them too much.
I'm book in hand, Vengeance. One of the chapters entitled "The Approach of Grasshoppers." What's happening here?
Well, that's a quote from one of the troopers in the 7th Cavalry. I should point out very quickly that, you know, most people think the 7th Cavalry was wiped out. It was not. There was about half of them survived. Custer's immediate command was wiped out. But there were others who survived the battle. And one of the quotes is that the Indians were coming so there were so many Indians coming at them, they were like an approach of grasshoppers. There was just too many to even comprehend.
And the first last stand is also a chapter here.
Yeah, there was the last stand of Custer and his men, but also a couple of his battalions survived, and they were under siege too. Once Custer and his immediate command were killed, the Cheyenne and Sioux turned their attention to the remaining soldiers, and they had to put up a last stand too, which in their case was successful because they held out long enough for reinforcements to arrive. So there was several battles within the major battle that I detail in the book.
Yes. What's another fact that we need to know when it comes to these last stands? We have time.
Well, you know, one of the things that fascinates me is that so much of the focus, understandably, is on George Armstrong Custer, because he was this charismatic celebrity figure. But the Battle of Little Bighorn is a tragedy for the Custer family. Custer died, his brother Tom died, his brother Boston died, his nephew Audie died, his brother-in-law Jimmy Calhoun died. It was a devastating loss for the entire Custer family. And, of course, when you think about the Custer parents, when they got the news that they had lost three sons, a grandson, and a son-in-law, it was just a powerful, you know, metaphor for how bad this loss was for the American people.
Yes. And the word vengeance, why use this as your title?
You know, that was sort of like a reason for doing the book in the first place, because as I detail in the book, so many of the events that took place in the battles that took place between American Indians and the U.S. Army, they were exacting vengeance for a previous battle. You know, the Federer massacre, okay, we've got to get even with that with the Sand Creek massacre. We've got to get the revenge for Little Bighorn. We've got to have revenge for the Wounded Knee massacre. There were so many of these interconnected battles and vengeance events that you could really see the eradication, almost eradication of the American Indian as one bit of vengeance after another.
And you're known for writing history that reads like a thriller. Is this purposeful? Tell us about how your reading style has progressed.
Well, thanks for that question, because I think vengeance is a good example of that. I experimented a little bit with shorter chapters, and the idea being that the end of one chapter immediately leads into the next one. And I'm not ashamed to say I wanted to write a page-turner. I mean, it's very well researched, and the information, as far as I know, is accurate. But I want people to read it like a novel. They could put it down and say, gosh, that was a good read, and I feel like I learned something.
Who were you reading, Tom Clavin?
I like to read thrillers, you know, like Michael Connelly and Ian Rankin. It's, you know, when I'm not reading for history and for research purposes, I like to go, you know, disappear into a good thriller novel.
You're halfway human then. What else do we need to know? How do we find out more information on Vengeance, and what are you working on next?
Well, I have a website, tomclavin.com, so you can find more information there. And I'm working on another book with my friend Bob Drury, which will be out in the fall, called The Phantom, about a super soldier, U.S. Marine, that was a two-story espionage behind enemy lines in France in 1944.
Great. Get to talk to you again on that. Final question, why should we read a good book, Tom?
Well, I think for one thing, it's a great experience to read a good book, to be caught up in a story. I think for another thing, it keeps our minds active and good exercise. And for another thing, it keeps people like me in business.
There is that. Tom Clavin, thank you very much. One more time, your website is?
TomClavin.com.
As it should be, C-L-A-V-I-N. Your latest is out, Vengeance, The Last Stands of Custer, Crazy Horse, and Sitting Bull. If you had to have a coffee with one of them, who would you have?
I would want to have coffee with Crazy Horse, because nobody really has ever, there's no depiction of him. And he's such a mysterious figure in American history. I'd love to have coffee with Crazy Horse.
There we are. Everyone has a dream. Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
Friedenberg on the line. His latest is out, Fighting for New York, Activism for Health and Social Justice Since the 1960s. I look forward to this conversation. You described as a veteran activist and CUNY scholar. More about you soon. Good morning, Nicholas.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Cheat you and more. Interesting setup. Imagine New York City without the activists who fought for it. Wages stuck at the federal minimum. Police stop and frisk without public oversight. I'll let you take it from there, Nick.
Sure. I've been participating and studying and teaching about activism in New York for more than 50 years. And I wrote this book in order to understand what activists have accomplished, what their limitations have been. And I was particularly focused on understanding, as a new series of threats to health arise in New York and, frankly, other cities and places, what have we learned that could help us to counteract those threats and to ensure that we can be a healthier people?
Let me ask, since the 1960s, why that a key decade?
Yes, I think what we saw in the 60s and the first part of the 70s was a flowering of social movements that arose in the period after World War II. They were inspired by the New Deal, by the labor movement, and then by the war on poverty. And that includes the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement, the labor movement, the lesbian gay movement. And those movements focused on a variety of issues, including health. And then around the 70s, we saw changes in the economy, changes in the politics. And so some of those accomplishments of the movements of the 60s were under challenge. And so I was particularly interested in looking at activism in New York City, a city where I've lived for a long time, and how it responded to those broader changes. And that's what I try and document in this book.
Yes, case studies of nine major New York campaigns across housing, labor, food, of course, environmental justice, and more. Give me an example.
Sure. I think a really important example was the Fight for 15 campaign. And that actually, that was an effort by low-wage workers to raise the minimum wage from the federal $7 an hour to $15 an hour. And it brought together workers in fast food and car washes and other places to organize and demand an increase in their wages. Because many of these workers worked for small employers, instead of using the traditional labor practice of negotiating with employers, they advocated for government action at the city level and the state level to raise the minimum wage. And they were successful. And the early successes in New York City set the stage for other cities and states and jurisdictions to also pass minimum wage laws. And so I think it's an example of people defining a problem, wages that didn't allow them to support themselves and their family, and then organizing to take action and modifying those actions in response to government decisions. So it's a great example. It also shows that how what starts in New York doesn't stay in New York, and we set a model for national action around low wages, also supported by many others in other parts of the country.
Does this also present, Nicholas, an honest accounting of activist failures and missed opportunities, not just victories?
Absolutely. And I think my goal in the book is both to celebrate the many successes and to document their contributions to improved health, and particularly to reducing the some of the disparities in health among different groups in New York. But it's also to say, where could we have done better? So, for example, New York State for more than 30 years has been trying to pass a universal health care law to make that most basic human need of access to health care available to all New Yorkers, no matter their income or their working status. And unfortunately, some special interests, the healthcare industry, many of the largest healthcare employers have opposed that bill, and so it hasn't passed. So the question is, what could be done differently? You know, how could we in the future achieve some of those successes?
Fighting for New York, activism for health and social justice since the 1960s. Nicholas Freudenberg on the line. Is this a closing call for the people of New York and other cities, as you say, to create a people's movement for health, which could be a shared agenda, what, across movements that, well, that have often too often worked in silos, I trust?
Yes, I think that you were asking about the limitations of movements, and I think many, even the successful movements in New York City, have focused on a single issue, making school lunches free, a great goal, ensuring that women have access to reproductive health services, including abortion, a really important issue, especially now. But many of them have not put together a coherent vision of a healthier society where people had the access to the essential needs for health, food, housing, health care. And I think by stitching together those different campaigns, we could have a different success. And that really, I think, is the challenge for this coming decade to see how we can unite. And I think the value of bringing together these sometimes siloed campaigns is they then articulate a vision of a society, of a city, of a place that ensures health for people and their children and their families. And I think almost everybody wants healthier families, healthier communities. And the question is, how do we get there? And that comprehensive vision, I think, is one of the pieces that's been missing.
What else do we need to know regarding this topic and why Michigan should care?
Yes, I think, first of all, the problems that we face in New York City now and in the past have often been a foreshadowing of the problems that other places face. So, for example, air pollution and ozone is a problem in Grand Rapids as well as New York City. Childhood lead poisoning, an issue I worked on in New York City for many years, is a problem in Michigan and in Massachusetts and in California. So the problems that we see in New York are problems facing everywhere. And I choose to focus on New York City because I know it best and because New York City has been the starting point of many of the most serious problems facing the nation. The AIDS epidemic, together with California and the Bay Area, New York was really the epicenter of that epidemic, similarly for COVID. So what we learn in New York City facing these threats to health should be distilled so that other people can benefit from that experience. And I think we in New York also have much to learn from people in other cities. I also think we need to start to put together the agenda for cities with the agenda for suburban areas, many of which are beginning to look more like cities, and for rural areas, which may face some of the same unmet needs as we're struggling with in New York City.
Fighting for New York. How do we find out more information, Nick?
The book is published by Columbia University Press, and you can go to the Columbia University Press website and order the book online. It will be officially released on July 7th. I'm hoping that some of your listeners will be interested in reading this and seeing how it relates to their places and their lives.
That's the bottom line. You, a distinguished professor emeritus of public health at the City University, of course, of New York School of Public Health, and author of Fighting for New York. Thank you very much, Nicholas.
Thank you.
Have you heard of the topic of cancer rehabilitation? June is National Cancer Survivors Month. We talk about the topic, how to work with it, and of course, the common questions asked about the topic. I bring on the best, Dr. Megan Clark. Appreciate you, and glad you're here. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Tell me how you spend your day.
Oh, I spend my day a little bit of everywhere and all over, wherever folks are needing me, in the hospital and in clinic, and even in some of the outpatient settings, rehab hospitals and skilled nursing facilities even.
Hence a conversation to have about your specialty. Let's get into the topic. What is cancer rehabilitation?
So cancer rehab is really focusing on the whole person that has been diagnosed with cancer, what that means to them physically, what that means to them mentally even, and how it's going to impact their life and what they're doing and want to be able to do.
And obviously, we talk about it as there is a whole month dedicated to National Cancer Survivors Month. There's also cancer, prehab?
There is. So, you know, we've been doing such amazing things in our cancer care, saving lives and keeping people going. But then what? You know, the question is, what are we doing to people through that treatment? What kind of side effects are they living with? So really, our cancer rehab is focusing on trying to restore that physical and emotional and even functional well-being during and after their cancer treatment.
Yes. Talk to me about after the diagnosis, you are now prescribing rehabilitation. Is exercise key?
Yes, it is. We know it is. You know, someone gets a cancer diagnosis and they're lining up for a battle, right? I mean, the cancer treatments are kind of like running a marathon, right? And so cancer prehabilitation is kind of the training camp for that marathon. We're using the time from diagnosis to the start of their treatment to really try and build that physical and mental reserves. We're getting them ready for the fight ahead.
And you most likely have run a marathon. I have as well. That's a whole different conversation. But what exercises would be recommended for this niche?
So really, like you said, movement is key, and it depends on the patient. It depends on, you know, baseline fitness and baseline level, what already, you know, a lot of people come into this and they already have a bum knee, or, you know, maybe they've got some physical impairments that they're not looking to run a marathon. And there are a lot of my patients for whom getting up off the couch and going into the bathroom is their marathon. And if that's where we're starting, then that's our marathon and that's where we're going to start. So a lot of it is that individualization and movement, moving more tomorrow than you did today, moving more next week than you did this week, just increasing that movement.
Talking all things cancer rehabilitation. Dr. Megan Clark with us. Dr. Clark, you were presented as a PM&R doctor. Specify the credential here.
So we get called a lot of things. So we're physical medicine and rehabilitation, or physiatrists. And our specialty is really the bones and muscles and joints and parts and pieces of a person and how that all works together to do all of the amazing things we want to do and need to do and want to continue to be able to do.
Thank you for that.
So we work in a variety of areas.
Yes, your research does encompass physical function tests for adults with, say, blood cancers, development of specialized curriculums for cancer rehab. Expand here.
Yes. So we really, we're wanting to look and see how is someone's baseline function, where we're starting, how is that going to impact their tolerance of their cancer treatments? Even for some people, it's how they respond to the cancer treatments. We're finding more and more that baseline physical function and having good endurance, having that good baseline cardiovascular fitness can even improve someone's recovery. Even how they tolerate their treatments and come through on the other side.
Yes. You've had multiple publications and reputable journals. Congratulations on that as well. And PMNR-led cancer rehab medicine is recognized as a standard of care in national oncology treatments, yes?
We are. We are because we're finding so much more that it is it's a key to a patient's ability to make it through their treatments, their response to their treatments. So it is as important as any of the other aspects of their care and their medical journey.
And what do you tell the next soul that has a cancer diagnosis that, well, most likely will need rehab in their life?
Yes. Start now. It's never too late. We can always gain. We can always make improvements. Be proactive. We are our own best advocates. So ask for that. Ask your oncologist for that rehab referral. Ask what you can do to be able to prepare yourself better. Be proactive.
Thank you. All right. How do I find out more information about this conversation and more, Dr. Megan Clark?
So I encourage people to go to our specialty website. So it's aapmr.org. People can find out more information about us. They can find out if they've got a cancer rehab doctor that can help them out, and more information on the specialty.
Great. Thanks. Take care. Appreciate the niche you have. Yes.
Thank you so much.
All right, there we are. Always important to address health every once in a while with our topics. There we are. All year, we celebrate this America's 250th anniversary. Ford bringing that story to life through a first-of-its-kind experience connecting 123 years of Ford with 250 years of American history through vehicles, artifacts that changed how the country lived, worked, and moved. I'm looking forward to this conversation. Ford Archives and Heritage Brand Manager Ted Ryan, glad that you're here. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning. So happy to be on with you today.
Yes, appreciate that and the good work our Ford does in our own backyard of this good state of Michigan. You, of course, the heritage and brand manager responsible for what? Preserving and sharing Ford's 120 plus years of history. There's a lot of history there for your day job.
There is, and we brought it to Washington, D.C. as part of the celebration for the 4th of July and America's 250th. We have 10 amazing vehicles in Union Station in Washington, D.C., free and open to the public. But then we plussed it up by also putting archive material on display that will further tell examples of the story. So answering the call, we have a Ford 1941 Ford GP on display, but we also have material on display from Willow Run and the great union workers who helped build the planes at Willow Run and who built the Jeep. So the Ford has been engaged and entwined with American history for 123 years, and this was a way to bring it to life to celebrate America's 250th.
Wonderful. And where does the this National America at 250 story go from here, as this is told through recognizable objects and vehicles? If we didn't get to see it this past week, where do we go?
Well, you can go see virtual versions of it on From the Road, which is Ford's website. And we recorded a series of videos of the different vehicles and of the different stories. We don't have a location for it to go next, but we have a demand for it to go somewhere next. Our own CEO, Jim Farley, was here yesterday, and he said, Ted, I want to see this again. So let's figure out where we're going to put it. Because it's when you see the cars and you see how much they've changed, you see the last Model T ever made. You see a beautiful 1956 T-Bird. You see an F-100. you can see that Ford has consistently adapted and changed to match the times. Best example of all is the 1964 World's Fair Mustang. This was one of the ones that was, when the Mustang was introduced in 64, it was part of the ride that Walt Disney created for Ford Motor Company. So amazing variety of vehicles that show the role that, that Ford has had in American history over these 123 of the 250 years.
Yes. Go give me a few more teases with what we can see with this.
My favorite two vehicles on display right now are a 1941 Ford GP, because most people aren't going to know, but Ford designed the classic World War II Jeep. It was a Ford body style. Later, they put a Willis engine in it when the government wanted a commonality of parts. Then it became the GPW, and Ford built 282,000 of those. But right across from it is the 1966 Bronco that won at Baja, the Baja 1000 in 1968, the first Bronco to ever win a race. So the Bronco was based on the design of the Jeep. So I put the two of them side by side so that the visitors could see the full story of how Ford helped save the world during World War II as the Arsenal of Democracy, but then later turned it into an amazing vehicle that won at Baja and we now sell today.
Talking all things celebration of America's 250 continues with July 4th coming and going, but for sure you've put together a wonderful opportunity for, on behalf of Ford Archives and Heritage, brand manager, you, Ted Ryan. What else is important that we know is, Ford is involved in this celebration?
Ford is deeply involved in this celebration because we wanted to celebrate America's 250th, and what better way to do it than to bring a free exhibit to the doorway of America. This is the second busiest train station in America, and millions of people are walking through. I'm sitting in it right now, and people are walking through taking pictures of the great cars that we brought in and reading the exhibit labels, and they're getting a feeling and an understanding of the impact that Ford has made with the $5 a day wage, the moving assembly line, the Model T, the F Series. And Ford has been so deeply ingrained in America and has been a part of its the fabric of America for 123 years, and this was a perfect way to bring it to life, free and open to the public.
Wonderful. And again, still available for our perusing in the virtual world. All right. Doing good things you are on behalf of Ford. Ted Ryan, how do we find out more information?
You can find out more information by going to Ford From the Road, which is our website. We have a great dedicated vertical where I've recorded seven videos about the seven different pillars that the exhibit addresses, and we've got beauty shots of the car. So if you can't make it in person to D.C. during the last 10 days it's open, you can check it out virtually.
Oh, road trip to D.C., why not? There we are. Ted, keep up your good work. Thank you.
Thank you so much.